This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
I've listened to Black Americans, and it's the most amazing use of the English language I've ever come across in my life.
I want more of your street no filter. I'm already writing the body language.
To me, we are the most beautiful creatures in the whole world, Black people.
Zora, she was always, you know, unapologetically Southern, unabashedly Black.
They want me to be like this and da-da-da just because they're scared of me. But I don't feel like that's my job, to humble myself, to show you that I'm not a threat.
We've been under siege, and it has forced us into some quite distorted self-conceptions.
Being brave to me about going outside and being confident in my skin implies that there's a problem with my skin.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. As we've been poking at the idea of Black History Month all this February, I've been thinking about Zora Neale Hurston, and particularly about her use of language, how she used it on the page, but also how she used it herself, the way she danced with words. There's this great radio interview in the WNYC archives. It's a 1943 conversation between her and the famous radio personality Mary Margaret McBride from a collection in the Library of Congress. And there's one part where she tells the story of how she learned to walk. She describes herself as a fat little baby who was too lazy to get up on her feet, which frustrated her mom. And then one day, here's what happened.
So, we lived in the country, and, we eat a lot of collard greens and turnip, things like that. And so she was going to have greens that day, and she went down to the well, which was some distance from the house, and left me sitting on the floor with a piece of cornbread in my hand to keep me quiet. And while she's down there, she said she heard me screaming, and she came running to see what's the matter, and when she got, she could hear the sow grunting in the house. The sow had come in the house. She smelt me eating this cornbread, and so she came in with her whole flock of pigs behind her to get the cornbread. But of course, at that tender age, I couldn't understand what that sow coming for. So when Mama got there, I had to pull up around that chair and was getting around it right smart. And I just started walking from then and just kept right on riding. So,
that shows how we learn a lot of things,
yeah.
I bet you.
The sow didn't exactly teach me how to walk, but she persuaded me I ought to try.
The sow persuaded me I ought to try. For me, the joy of this, the linguistic art of it, is in the phrasing. The way she mixes her diction and her proper vocabulary with just totally unapologetically country ideas and syntax. Anyway, the thing about Black History Month, what makes it sometimes complicated, is it's not only about learning our history. It's also one of these moments when we, as Black people, are often prompted to represent something more than our individual unique versions of humanity. When we have to think about our Blackness in relationship to everybody else's ideas of it, very much including other Black people's ideas. And that's why I've got Zora Neale Hurston on my mind, her and her language. She's now considered one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, but in her time, she was largely dismissed because she refused to adapt her voice to meet everyone else's expectations. To talk about that, we have invited author Bernice L. McFadden to join the show. Hey, Bernice, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Bernice McFadden is the author of several award-winning novels, most recently Praise Song for Butterflies in 2018 and The Book of Harlan in 2016, which won both the American Book Award and the NAACP Image Award. She and I are both contributors to a new collection called 400 Souls, A Community History of African America. And Bernice, you wrote just this lovely piece about Zora Neale Hurston in that collection. So first off, thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much.
And can we just start by walking through Hurston's rapid rise and fall among critics in the 1930s, which you kind of chronicle in that essay. So her first novel comes out in 1934. It's called Jonah's Gourdvine. And it was well received by white critics. The New York Times praised her use of what was then called Negro dialect, which, of course, was just the way Black people talked in the Deep South. But you point out that the white critics fundamentally misunderstood something about her relationship to that language. Can you explain that?
Yes. So one of the reviewers commented that, that she handled the Negro dialect so well. And she seemed to be a bit surprised by that because Zora had been educated in, a white I believe, Ivy League university. And so I found that really very interesting that this white critic just completely dismissed the fact that Zora, you know, had been born in Alabama, raised in Florida, both in, you know, Black communities. And so she was writing about home. This language was not foreign to her. It was absolutely a huge part of her.
It's almost like the critic wanted to make Zora part of her own sort of outside observance of Southern Black people, as opposed to letting Zora just be Zora.
I agree. Absolutely.
Well, okay, so 2 years later, Hurston publishes the book for which she's now most famous, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Mm-hmm. And again, she really embraces the so-called Negro dialect. But by this point, her language is being rejected by some Black figures, most notably Richard Wright. What did he say about mm-hmm. her work?
Well, basically, he felt that she was playing into the stereotypes created by the dominant group, white folk. And he was working to move away from those so-called stereotypes because mm-hmm. he didn't think that it serviced the Black community. Completely dismissing, of course, that, you know, language is a tool. And it's a tool that we use to maintain our identity. And that's exactly what Zora was doing.
Right. He didn't think it served the Black community. In what way?
Well, I think that he felt that if Zora was writing in that dialect, right, that dialect had been labeled as the language of people who were uneducated and, quite frankly, stupid and inferior. Mm-hmm. And he certainly wanted to distance himself away from that.
Right. And here she was, somebody who went to Barnard College, as you point out, quite mm-hmm. educated, in fact, and yet unapologetically yes. embracing this language.
Right.
The book goes out of print about a year later, I think, and falls into obscurity, which I think is something maybe a lot of people now don't know about Zora Neale Hurston's work. And it wasn't really widely read and celebrated again until the 1970s when Alice Walker and other Black women draw attention to it. Why do you think that is? Why did this book get dismissed by our own people?
Again, because we had been indoctrinated to believe that language like that was for the lower class. And we certainly didn't want to be a part of the lower class, although we were automatically considered a part of the lower class simply by the color of our skin. When Alice Walker came along and brought with her Zora Neale Hurston and Janie, I think it resonated because Alice Walker had also written The Color Purple using the same sort of dialect. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, hey, this is who we are. We need to celebrate this.
Right. Do you think something had shifted in Black culture that made it more acceptable when Alice Walker started using it, or did she in fact make the shift?
That's a complex question. I don't know. I mean, it could have been a little bit of both. It could have been a little bit of both. I mean, this is following, you know, the Black Power movement, and people are starting to search for their roots, and they're very concerned with their ancestors and wanting and needing to celebrate them. So I'd like to think that was the reason.
Right. Well, in your essay in 400 Souls, you say that when you discovered Their Eyes Were Watching God now in 1987, that a door in your mind loudly cracked ajar, which is a beautiful turn of phrase as well, I think.
Thank you.
Let's talk about that door. First off, why? What was it that about this book that hit you so?
So I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I read a lot as a child, but I'd never read a book written by a Black person, written about Black people. I went to high school, mostly white high school, boarding school in rural Pennsylvania. So I certainly wasn't introduced to any Black writers there. And I knew I wanted to be a writer because, again, I was, you know, a huge reader. But I was like, well, how am I going to do this? I don't have any role models. And who am I going to write about? Right? And so when I picked up The Color Purple and I finished it in one sitting, I was like, oh, my goodness. I know these people. Like, this is my family. But I didn't think that I could write about my family. Who wanted to read about my family? And that book gave me permission to do so.
Well, and on language in particular, it sounds like you sort of grew up in two different worlds because of your education, which I can relate to, and I imagine a lot of listeners can as well. Like you said, you were educated at these sort of these fancy private schools and spent your summers in Brooklyn and Barbados, I gather.
Yes.
And that created this tension in language for you. Can you describe that tension sort of between how adults wanted you to speak and how you and them, frankly, actually spoke?
So a lot of the adults in my life, again, like on my mother's side, my family came up from Georgia in the 40s. And on my Caribbean side, my family came up from Barbados in the 20s. So they had their own very particular ways of speaking, but they also understood that there was the right way to speak. And it was all about don't do what I do what I say. I know I'm speaking this way, but this is not the right way, because if you go out into the white world speaking like this, you will have doors shut in your face. You're not going to get a job. You're not going to be able to, you know, get into the right schools. You're not going to be able to, you know, exist with the right people who can help you advance here in America. So, but I love the music in the language. And I absorbed it. So I was playing this code switching before I even understood what code switching meant. I was already doing it.
Right. You called it your dialect Yankee Bajan, I think.
Yankee Bajan.
Yankee Bajan. Describe what that means.
Yankee Bajan is it's really what Barbadians say about Bajan descendants. Right. So like my great-grandparents came here and they had my grandmother here. And so she would have been considered a Yankee Bajan. And my grandmother was really apt at switching between like full-on Bajan, even though she was born and raised in Brooklyn, and then her Brooklynese.
Which is its own dialect.
Yes, it is.
My mother will probably be annoyed when she hears me say this, but I have always teased her about her own country roots, being from Alabama. And she has two very different ways of talking, depending on whether she's trying to be formal or she's just comfortable, you know? And I think I picked that up from her as well. And all the Black people who raised me, they were hyper-literate, they were well-educated, could speak proper English better than most, honestly, but that is just not how they talk to each other.
Right.
And, you know, and it took me a long time, I have to say, before I realized even how often I also just shifted between those two without thought. And it just seems to me reading your essay about Zora Neale that you were at least a little more thoughtful or deliberate about it than me. You write that, you know, you consider yourself bilingual in this way. When did that click for you? When and how did it click that this your way of thinking about it?
I think it probably clicked for me in my early 30s. And I'm sure it's because a school friend, one of the women I went to school with in Danville, Pennsylvania, who is not Black. And I think she was visiting and she heard me in conversation with my mother. And then when I returned to her, I was speaking a bit differently. And she pointed that out to me like, oh, that's different. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, but in your household, I think what we don't realize is that everyone does it.
Right.
Everyone does it. And I explain that to my students too. I said, the way you speak to me is not the way you speak to your friends. So right. We all do it for various reasons.
Right. It's just when you add race to it, then it becomes complicated.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. How does all this show up in your own writing? How does this bilingualness and thought about how you choose speech, how does that show up in your books?
If a friend of mine pointed out to me, and it's something that happens quite holistically. This is a woman who was born here in Brooklyn, but she has roots in Barbados. So she wasn't raised down there. So she went down and spent a few years and she got a hold of my book, Sugar. This is before we knew each other. And she said she knew immediately that I had Bajan roots because even though I was writing about Southern people in a Southern town, I didn't say, when I was talking about the food, I didn't say, oh, you know, so-and-so baked a pan of macaroni and cheese. I said, oh, they made macaroni pie. And she's like, that's a Bayesian thing. So I like to do that. Whatever word I feel fits in with the scene, whether it's from my Southern roots or my Bayesian roots, I just put it in. So I like to play with language like that. And you know, there are other dialects that I enjoy hearing. And, you know, I live in New Orleans now, and so they have beautiful, beautiful dialect. Indeed. And, yeah, I've been dropping a few of those words in my most recent work.
Right. I at the beginning of the show, I said we're having this conversation because, you know, in the middle of Black History Month, I think a lot about the way in which our individual forms and expressions of Blackness have to carry all this weight from outside, from beyond ourselves as individuals, both from America at large, but also from other Black people. And I guess I just want to sort of throw that at you. What do you think about that? And particularly thinking about language. I mean, it doesn't sound like you do carry anything with it, that you're able to just be centered on you and how you speak. But how do you think about that? And what would you say to others about how to get where you are?
I just feel like we have to be our authentic selves, whatever that is, and ignore the gaze, whether it be white, male, or, you know, whatever, and just do what we're comfortable doing. And I also feel that once we let go of all of that, you know, stuff that weighs us down, like Toni Morrison said, we can absolutely fly. And we could fly in our literature, we could fly in our creativity, and that would be, I think it would make it all the more layered and certainly richer and beautiful.
Thank you. Bernice L. McFadden is the author of several award-winning books, most recently the 2018 novel Praise Song for the Butterflies. She wrote about Zora Neale Hurston in the new collection, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America. I hope you'll check it out. I've got an essay in there as well. Bernice, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
You too. Before we take a break, I want to leave you with a little gem of an anecdote that Zora Neale Hurston shared in that 1943 interview with Mary Margaret McBride. And I'll say it's apropos of absolutely nothing other than the fact that it makes me smile. And in it, she's describing a realization she has as a child about her place in the cosmos.
Well, if you go outdoors tonight and the moon is up, I forget just what state the moon is in right now, but anyhow, if the moon is shining, you go out and you run and it'll follow you.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I thought it made a special effort to just keep up with me. and I was so shocked when I found out it followed other people, because I felt just I was something very special. And so it was arranged so the moon would follow me. Whichever way I run, the moon would follow me, just like a puppy dog. And it's sort of disillusioning when I found out other people were making the same claim on the moon.
Zora Neale Hurston in the cosmos. Thanks to the estate of Mary Margaret McBride for letting us use those recordings. Hurston's life story is a reminder of the ways in which language can be a source of tension for Blackness, between how we think about our own individual selves and the things everybody else wants to project onto us. Coming up, another story where we talk about the source of that kind of tension in our bodies. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We're noodling around with Black History Month again this week, and with the complex relationship a lot of us have to it. One of the sort of weird things about it, particularly when you're younger, is it's this moment when, as a Black person, we're often prodded to represent something more than our own individual selves, in which we're confronted with that what everybody else projects onto our Blackness, including other Black people. There is maybe no sharper point of projection than our skin tones. And our senior producer, Vera Lynn Williams, has a family story about what it feels like to unexpectedly find yourself on the receiving end of other people's ideas about your brown skin. Take a listen.
So Kai, as I've been working on this Black History Month series, I've thought a lot about this difficult conversation I had with my sister.
Hi, I'm Lovis Williams, and I am Marilyn Williams' sister.
You know, you two sound exactly alike, right?
Yes, we get that a lot. And growing up, everyone also said we looked alike. We both are round, short girls with the complexion I am now. Think Hershey's milk chocolate bar. That was true until she turned 13. And Lovis remembers that exact moment.
We were in a supermarket and you're like, oh, what's that spot? What are those spots in, on your hands? And I was like, I don't know, because it was just really little and I didn't really think much of it. And I think that after the little spots on my hand is when I started to see like my lips pinkening. And so that's when I first noticed it.
It took a while for anyone in the family to take in exactly what was happening to her.
I think I remember going with Dad to the dermatologist for the first time and just kind of figuring out, like, what is this all about?
This is what we found out.
Assessment that it is vitiligo.
Vitiligo is an autoimmune disorder. And having any autoimmune issue means your body, for whatever reason, attacks your healthy tissues. In my sister's case, this is her skin pigmentation.
And wait, what does that even mean? So, like, her skin is losing its color, or what does that mean?
Well, there is a wide spectrum, but essentially, yes, my sister's skin started to lighten. And this is what the doctor told her.
Like, oh, it could be that, you know, you get a little bit of spots and it just doesn't progress, or it could progress to the rest of your body. So for me, I was just like, hopefully it's not the lot.
Wow, that's a lot. I mean, to see your skin start to change, that would be, to me, that would be scary.
Mm-hmm. And we had no clue what would even happen, like what the extent of it could look like, right? So for me, Michael Jackson was my only reference to someone right. Whose complexion completely changed. And it never dawned on me, never occurred to me that my sister would go from being Michelle Obama's complexion to that of Meghan Markle.
And I mean, there's so much here too. I mean, this is complicated stuff. As soon as we start getting into skin tones amongst mm-hmm. Black people, and even those two examples.
Yeah. And on top of that, my sister was only 13.
And I remember being in eighth grade, going back into eighth grade and having it. Because I met my friends before in sixth grade, my friends that you know now, Tika and Melissa. You know, my Black Girls in Action, as we called ourselves back then.
I forgot that you guys had named yourselves Black Girls in Action. Mm-hmm. Like, you had, like, a book or something.
Right, we had, like, a book. We had a mission statement. we did events. We celebrated each other's birthdays in big ways. We were serious.
You identified as a Black girl, like that mm-hmm. was a big part of your identity. So mm-hmm. when your appearance started to change, like, did it impact how you felt?
I mean, at that time, like at the end of eighth grade, it wasn't too bad. It was just like on my nose. But then I started using makeup and stuff to help with anything on my face. As long as I wore my makeup, I was still Black. Like, I was still considering myself Black. Even into high school, like, it didn't challenge that because I was still mostly Black, I guess you could say, because I had spots. Like, I was transitioning. So it was more of a period of transition. You know, there was no question and no one questioned that.
When Lovis says, I was still Black, I know what she means, but I'm not gonna lie, I flinched every single time she said it. I want to clarify that I am interpreting what you're saying in the way that I think you are, which is like you're saying I was mostly like brown skin.
Yeah, my skin color hadn't transitioned out of brown skin and my skin tone was mostly, you know, and I'm saying Black because I, you know, but still a brown skin woman who identified as a Black woman. Mm-hmm. So
could you still identify it?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, and even with someone who is as fair as I am, like, no one looks at me and thinks that I am at least not a person of color because of my features.
By the time she graduated from college, all of her brown skin was gone, but she still wore brown makeup. So to the world, her complexion still looked like mine.
I've never questioned my identity and who I am while others have. So mm-hmm. if there's a question of, am I Black? You know, that's just not something I've ever questioned internally, but I do question what other people think I am, mm-hmm, which is very mm-hmm. different.
I hear you on the like double, triple, quadruple consciousness that mm-hmm. happens when you walk into any space. But has maybe a version of your worst case scenario ever happened?
I can remember like one time, I was at work.
My sister works at the Bronx Courthouse.
I'm a part of like the Black History Month committee in the courts, and we do Black events every February. And so I'm the person who's conscious enough to just be like, oh, we're going to be doing this event. We're having Black Jeopardy at 3:00. So come. And so I remember being in a meeting with my director and a few other people, and we were talking about, it was something that was race related. And I made a comment, it was an uncomfortable conversation because we have a deputy director who is white and our director who is Dominican. And I think the deputy director said something that was not culturally sensitive. But I remember saying something like, well, you know, as a Black person, I do get like no one's going to call me on it because as a Black person, you know, that whole racial comments that we make are not given the scrutiny that white people. And we can say that. And my director was like, well, you're the fairest woman in here. This is my director saying that to me. Like she attributed my skin, my fairness to my Blackness. And I was like, what does that have to do with anything anyway? But I remember that sticks out to me a lot because I remember her saying it as if it's a challenge to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what does that have to do with my Blackness or me being Black? Mm-hmm. You know, so. Mm-hmm.
And what about in like Black spaces?
Black spaces. I don't know if you would call the courthouse a Black. Well, there are lots of Black mm-hmm. bodies in there, and that's where I work. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I guess you could call it that, you know. And I remember I was like filling in the front desk. I don't know if I told some woman who'd come in, Black woman. She came in, she was sitting down, and I think I was just like, we only let people who are entering in the program have a seat in here. If you're a family member, whatever, you have to wait outside. Like, our policy is that because we don't have enough chairs for everyone. And she was upset that I was telling her to sit outside, and she was just like, don't let the red bone get to your head. I was like, okay. But like, I guess she was saying, you know, she was a brown-skinned woman, and I'm telling her that she has to step out. And I don't know if it was maybe it was the way I said it to her, or maybe she felt like I was like talking down to her, or I don't know. But then she made that comment as if to say that I thought I was better than her, or I was acting as if to say, well, you're Black, so I don't know why you're acting like that. Or I don't know. But I'm just telling you, people have a lot of ideas about just skin. And I know that we, you know, there are levels of privilege, right? We know that there's a conversation we can have all day. But there's levels of privilege in America, and a lot of it is attributed to how light or dark, you know. I'm very cognizant of that, but I also feel like people, you know, it can happen in the reverse where we're constantly just like, well, you know, you're light skinned, so, you know, you're just not as close to the cause, or you have like a check, like an outbox.
Kai, there have been plenty of moments I had to check someone talking sideways in my hearing because they didn't know the woman they were talking about is my sister. Mm. You know, saying things like, who is this wannabe white woman? Mm. Something to that effect. And I've never brought it up to her because it's always felt too painful.
Like, I remember mom driving me, like, deep into Westchester because it was, like, another, like, a treatment, like, a light treatment. And I remember exactly, like, the logistics of what happened. But it ended up being, like, either it wasn't a good candidate because of, like, the amount that it spread or something of that nature. I remember feeling disappointed of not being able to do it because I feel like I had maybe had hopes of it being something that could be helpful for me.
And helping
with the pigmentation. Like repigmentation.
Okay.
And so I was really, I just remember that feeling of just like, just kind of like hopeless. This isn't going to work.
And like, what did that, like, once you realized that this was just the way that things were going to be, how did that change the way that you moved through the world, maybe? You know what I mean?
I mean, did it have an impact on, possibly like an impact on me just socially? I don't know if I really developed many strong relationships after junior high, so possibly.
When she was in grad school, I remember I told Lovis that she should just stop wearing the brown makeup altogether. And turns out her boyfriend at the time did too.
even though you told me, he told me, it wasn't the reason why I stopped wearing makeup was because his brother told me, you know, you're my family. He was like family. And when your family tells you something, like, you'd be like, okay, whatever. It's just your family. They love you and they don't care. They'll love you no matter what. But then when you hear from someone who's outside, it just takes on a different, I guess, a life of its own that's very different. You're like, okay, maybe that's something I should think about. And so actually that's when I stopped.
That's like over a decade of wearing makeup. What was it like stopping?
It was challenging. Maybe like a couple weeks after, not even right away. I was wearing like street no makeup. Like a couple weeks after stopping is when I went to Macy's and they started doing, like, they'll, you know, the makeup people, they were trying to figure out which one. And so right now I wear ivory, which is like close to zero. I think it's like maybe one.
Wow.
As opposed to the seven that I was using before. You know, we attribute a community to color. We just do. And I think that for me was difficult to let go because that is a part of who I am. Like, you know what I'm saying? Being brown skin, you know, with all of the bad that comes with that for people developing ideas about black people and less than, there's also a community in circle that you're just a part of something that now I'm learning as an older person that skin color is about a cultural experience, not so much about skin color. But before, as a young person, you know, being black is, you know, it's being black. Like all of the people that we listen to, Brandy, Foxy Brown, even Little Kim, like these were all black women. These Whitney Houston, brown skin women. Like this is something that I have in common with the women that I love to listen to. And so I feel like for me, it was definitely difficult. And so I think I did the makeup thing for a very long time when I feel like I didn't have to because I attributed my skin color was being a part of the community. And like that, as a young woman, I think that we have a very simplistic view about what it means to be black because, you know, now I know that that's not true. But being young, you don't really think about you're black. You know, you're black because you're brown. Like that's why you're black.
You know, in so many ways, my sister's experience as a black woman who has experienced the world in both brown and ivory skin reinforces what I've felt in my skin, which is loving my black self, that's the easy part. But doing so in a society based on a racial caste system, that's the struggle.
And I think that, you know, that evaluation is very much, I feel like it comes stronger from the black population, the evaluation of who you are as a black person based on skin tone. Like, at least from my perspective, I do a lot black history. I push a lot of things like we need to do things that are racially relevant just in my places and spaces of work. And I'm very much pushing that. And I don't know. I feel like sometimes that's questioned. It's just like, well, why do you feel like, what are you trying to prove? Because, like, am I trying to prove nothing? No.
For me, Lovis's story and Zora Neale Hurston's story and Bernice McFadden's story, for that matter, they're all examples of how people have managed to hold on to their own, to hold on to their individual expressions of blackness, despite what other people, black, white, and everybody else, wanted to project onto them. So what about all of you? I want to hear from some of our black listeners about how you pull that off. When do you feel most true and authentic in your own blackness? How do you express it? I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, and we'll be right back to talk with you. Hey, this is Kai. So just a quick program note here. When we started making this show back in 2016, we were just trying to bring context to that wild campaign season, and particularly the history that we all carried into it. And initially, we figured we'd stop after that election, but obviously, there was a lot more to chew on. Which is just to say, if you're new to the show, there are tons of episodes here that I hope you'll check out. We've taken snapshots of the political culture.
It's not right. I'm sorry. I feel bad for people that are like oppressed, and I mean oppressed. But, you know, if we got to take care of our own too.
We've asked how power is really built in a democracy.
I don't believe that demography is destiny. I think demography is a pathway, but it takes work. And we are the first campaign in the Deep South to put in the work.
And we've just mined all kinds of history in an effort to put America on the couch, to understand how we got here as a country and where we're going. So I urge you to dig around in the archives. It is all still relevant. And, you know, if you hear something that raises new questions for you and you want us to follow up on that, hit me up. Email me at anxiety@wnyc.org and maybe we'll take you up on it. Thanks a bunch. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and I am with our senior producer, Vera Lynn Williams. Hey, Vera Lynn.
Hey, Kai. How you doing?
So we've spent the month poking around at Black History Month. If you've missed previous shows, you can go to our website, wnyc.org/anxiety. There's a tab there that's called Collections, or labeled Collections. And under that heading, you'll find all the shows in this series, so go check them out. And I said at the start of the month that I've always been kind of offish about Black History Month. And now as the month heads toward an end, maybe we are getting at the heart of the matter for me. Because for whatever the reason, growing up, February was one of those times, again, for me, in which I was confronted by other people's ideas about what my Blackness was supposed to be, whether those were limiting ideas coming from within my community or frankly bizarre ideas coming from those outside of the community. I had to find my way to my own authentic self-expression of Blackness. And for the rest of the show, we want to hear from our Black listeners about your own singular self-expressions of Blackness. Call us at 646-435-7280. Again, that's 646-435-7280. Okay, So Vera Lynn, before we get to these calls, you said that our work on Black History Month and these episodes made you think about the conversation that you had with your sister, and that it brought it up for you. So why? What triggered that for you?
Well, I mean, it's funny, and it's also like listening to it, knowing that the world potentially is listening and my sister's listening. Right. It felt harder, even though I've like played this over and over again, because it's like one of those things that was always just felt really complex and hard and taboo, and you know, we don't talk about it out loud, right? Like this feeling of like, how is this going to impact her? Like my protective feeling around my sister, right? Mm-hmm. And so as we've been talking about how we celebrate our history and our culture, especially during this month, which I've unapologetically done.
Indeed.
I guess it struck me, you know, hearing even you and hearing the cuts being like, you and your sister even celebrate Black history the same. Like, it never occurred to me. And so I guess I've also just been unpacking how maybe I've also internalized the difference within my sister, right? So like witnessing how people relate to her because of her skin, and she calls it her transition, how that maybe shaded how I experienced the celebration of Blackness that she's always had.
Oh, wow. Wow. From her own sister. I mean, because it's hard, right? You know, we're human beings.
Yeah.
Well, let's start bringing in some calls. Lisa Marie in West Orange, New Jersey. Lisa Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Kai.
Hello.
I'm so excited to be talking to you about this. I could not believe that you didn't start off this discussion with the Glenn Ligon painting, "I Feel Most Black Against a Blank White Background."
Ooh. Say more.
Over and over and over again.
Say more about that for yourself.
So where I feel most affirmed in my Blackness is in the context of my immediate family that I was born into. But the way that I feel affirmed in that is the way that a fish feels affirmed by water. Mm. You swim in it. You don't think about it. You take it for granted. You enjoy it until you're taken out of the water. so when I left Cincinnati, Ohio, to come to the Northeast, you know, to go to college, and all of a sudden I was in an environment that where there wasn't really any water. Like, you had to walk, you know, a fair number of blocks off of campus to find any water in terms of Black culture or Black community. I became very aware that, oh, wait a second, here is this beautiful context that I had around me. And I had gone to high school in a primarily white environment, right? You test into these environments, and as they get more exclusive, they get whiter and whiter. But I did not realize how much I was going to miss my water until the well ran dry.
Wow.
So that's the context. Being at home with my family in Cincinnati, where even just talking about them now, I can hear that Cincinnati twang that actually sounds like the Kentucky that many Cincinnatians migrated from.
That's my grandmother is from Kentucky. Yeah. Give me just one beat of it real quick before I let you go. Give me one beat of that Cincinnati twang, if you're willing.
Well, you know, when I get going like that, people can't understand what I'm saying. So I don't know if these Yankees up here, because that's what they call us, Yankees, are even going to understand what I have to say.
Thank you so much, Lisa Marie, for that. Let's hear from Mike in the Bronx. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. What about you?
So I think that I am most proud when I see successful Black people in spaces where maybe there hasn't been a lot of them before. That's a real, to me, a point of pride. So I look there was a college football player a few years ago. He played for Florida State. You obviously have to be pretty good to play for them. But he went on. He's a brain surgeon now. Myron Roll. I said, I mean, you're proud to see that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I look at the guy. I mean, I don't know who I'm going to vote for mayor, but Ray McGuire. I mean, look, he went to Wall Street and he made a lot of money. I mean, go for it, you know?
Well,
and
that's,
I think despite all the adversity, you're very proud of everything that Black people have managed in this country, despite, the obstacles, obviously. And I would just make one other point is that, you know, we're all three-dimensional humans. Like, I've noticed in our popular culture that the only people who are anti-heroes are white men. You know, Tony Soprano, the Breaking Bad character, Bryan Cranston was playing. I think the Trump candidacy was sort of a weird, for some people, was like a weird anti-hero vigilante thing. And even, this is sort of, I'm dating myself, but if you may remember Stone Cold Steve Austin from the WWE was sort of an anti-hero. But
you're dating me too. I sure do.
Minorities and women, I think, are unfortunately pigeonholed into a small handful of roles in American popular culture, you know, victims of violence, you know, there's only a few roles that they let us play. But I get a real kick out of it when you see Black people succeeding where there just haven't been very many. Before.
Thank you very much for that. Either of those things, you want to respond to either what Lisa Marie or what Mike had to say?
It's interesting having them be back to back because, you know, as Mike was talking, I was thinking about Donald Glover in Atlanta. And I think that's an example of an anti-hero, right?
Right.
And so it's interesting how we think about our Blackness in relationship to whiteness. And I think, like, to me, you know, that's my point is, like, Black history doesn't have to have anything to do with white people. Like, we could, you know, when I think about when I'm most affirmed, and I thought about this when Lisa Marie was talking, you know, it's like being in Sierra Leone or being in Cape Town or, you know, just like being in an African market haggling with, you know, who I call my aunties, you know, and trying to, like, knowing that I'm probably going to pay whatever they said, but there's that practice of haggling, you know, like that like, and it's like, it's now no one is out here telling me I'm being too aggressive. Like, that's what you need to do in order to get the thing that you're asking for. So I think, like, it's just like whenever I'm able to be in a space where I don't have to question how I'm being perceived in relationship to whiteness. So it's
is, you know, and I guess also like just thinking about like the Lances of the world, right? So like who are like what are the what is the work of Black people that we can lift up and talk about as opposed to talking about, and I'm not saying this is what Mike is saying, but as opposed to talking about what the deficit, like what right. is what does exist.
Well, like Mike said, he loves the idea of watching Black people succeed, you know. So I'm thinking about, oh yeah, you know, the origins of Black History Month, that's part of where we started here, and that's sometimes put me off, that focus on exceptionalism, but it is also something that is just to celebrate. We do well, you know. Let's hear from Rob in Brooklyn. Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening. What about you? How
yeah.
How you...
Well, it's interesting because I feel most affirmed. I have several incarnations and lives, but the thing that I called about was doing something that traditionally may not be associated with Blackness. I am a social salsa dancer. And I've been doing it for quite a while. And when I go dancing, and I'm pretty fair, people normally assume that I'm not from Brooklyn. Oh, are you from Cuba? And, are you from, you know, this country or that country? No, I'm from Brooklyn. You know, I got roots in all of those places. You know, and that's a show you should really do, Kai. On all of us Caribbean folk washed up here, but
I agree.
The thing is that this particular dance and its expression has very definite African roots, and that expression in the way I dance and you know many of my associates is something that comes through, and it helps affirm our expression of this particular act of art.
Thank you for that, Rob. Let's go to Renee in New Jersey. I'm not sure where in New Jersey.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. So I was just wanted to come from a different take. So I feel like I'm most comfortable really just being me, right? I'm an African-American female. I'm darker skinned. And ironically, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, like the other caller. But I just have a different take. And I'm sometimes afraid to speak up about it because I don't want people to think like, oh, she has a blind eye or she's ignorant or naive. Not at all. I see everything that's going on. But I haven't personally experienced a lot of racism. I feel like I've been able to go to school to do the things I need to do to achieve my goals. And I've never had anything that I would say racism toward me. I have white family members and I have white friends. And now I kind of feel uncomfortable because I think like they feel uncomfortable. They're kind of walking on eggshells, like they want to make sure they're politically correct. But I don't feel like I've been discriminated against all the time. You know, I don't feel like I'm being held back, but I know we are as a people. So please don't get me wrong on that. Yeah. But does anyone have any take on that? I know I can't be the only one that feels like this, but we're quiet about it because we don't want to get, you know, banished from the Black community. We don't want to be a Raven Simone, or we don't want to get banished like Don Lemon or something like that. But I'm just saying.
Hey, Don Lemon is back on the good graces.
Right. I know he is. Well, Stacey Dash. I said you.
Virilyn, quickly, you know, one of the things that we haven't talked about is sort of just the way Black people put things on each other. And I want to ask you about that because I know you're going to be having a conversation about this coming up.
Yes, on Tuesday, we're going to be talking to Rebecca Carroll, who is our colleague, former colleague here at WNYC, and she just wrote a book. And, you know, and even in the call that we just had, I was thinking about just, I grew up in Black schools. I went to predominantly Black schools my whole life. It wasn't until I entered a professional setting that I was in relationship to white people in a more ongoing circumstance. And I guess I think about just the same struggles that, or same conflicts that we had based on hair or based on even, you know, I was telling you, it's kind of a just based on perceptions of sexuality and Black girls and fast girls, you know, just like the little things that people say because you are Black.
Yeah.
I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to stop talking. But
well, you can continue it on Tuesday, 7 p.m. on WNYC's Instagram page. Virilyn will be in conversation with Rebecca Carroll about her new book. and they will hash all of this out. Thanks to those who called and tweeted. Apologies if I didn't get to you. You can always email me at anxiety@wnyc.org. We particularly love to get a voice memo, so if you had something you wanted to say, record it, send it over, anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks so much for spending this time with us. I'm Kai Wright. Happy Black History Month. I'll talk to you next week. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. A special thanks to the estate of Mary Margaret McBride for the use of her 1943 radio interview with Zora Neale Hurston. Joe Plord mixed the podcast version this week. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. A congrats, by the way, to our usual engineer, Jared Paul, on his brand new baby girl. Welcome to the world, Sylvia. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Frohman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And of course, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.